Hi, Chris.
Hello. How's it going, Rob?
How are you?
Pretty
I'm
good.
Good. How are you? Happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, thanks.
How was it?
We went to see a movie.
What did you see?
Knives Out.
No, I've seen that it's out, but I don't know anything about it or who's in it. What type of a movie is it?
It's a modern mystery.
Uh-huh.
Murder mystery, but it plays with a lot of the conventions of the genre.
Oh, okay. Where are some of the stars?
Jamie Lee Curtis is in it.
I've heard of her.
Captain America.
Oh.
What's his name? Chris Evans.
Uh-huh.
James Bond, Daniel Craig.
Oh, Daniel Craig's in it.
Who else? Don Johnson. That's the Miami Vice guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people in it.
What did you think?
It was good. It was. Yeah? I thought it was really good. It was. Rian Johnson. Is it Rian or Rian?
I don't know. I think it's Rian.
Yeah, I thought it was just like a funny spelling.
Yeah.
I've generally liked his movies. I liked Looper.
I haven't seen Looper.
That was pretty good. And
I heard that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty good. We didn't really have anything going on. I mean, we generally don't do a whole lot. Every other year, my wife's parents go out to New York City area for my brother-in-law's, and my sister does stuff with her husband's family, and
yeah, so is my brother with his wife's, yeah.
Yeah, and my parents for the last few years my mom's just cooked dinner for my grandmother and her brother, my uncle. So this year my parents just went and decided to go to Florida.
Oh, wow.
So we didn't really have anything going on, which I didn't care. I don't really care that much about Thanksgiving, so we just it was a normal day, except for which we went to matinee in the afternoon. So
that's cool. Now in the afternoon, if you're going in the early to mid afternoon, is it very quiet there, very few people, or is there still a lot? Because I know Thanksgiving evening can be quite busy, but what about earlier in the day?
I think it seemed fairly quiet.
Yeah, that's what I kind of figured.
Yeah.
Wouldn't really get out there until, like, dinner was over for the most part.
Yeah, I think people tend to do their Thanksgiving meals in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Maybe. Plus, I think, was that? No, it was. I think we went around 1 o'clock, so I was going to say that.
Oh, so it's quite early.
Yeah. And then you had the football game, which was
obviously who was playing?
Is that a real question or?
Wise guy.
Those two, you're too dry. I'm usually the one that's pulling that at people. But yeah,
I was in a. I mean, we didn't have a large gathering. It's Stacy's mom, brother, and his son, and then my parents, my mom and dad, and that's it. But I'm literally the only one in the room that really, really doesn't care if the Bills win or lose.
Yeah.
Like, I used to be a big football fan, but kind of fell away from it over the past several years.
Yeah, same here. I mean, I've had periods in my life where I watched it, mostly when I was younger and they had the Super Bowl runs.
Sure.
And then And then for a little while, at one point when I didn't live in this area, I kind of maybe made me feel more connected to home or something. But
Where did you live? This is something new that I didn't know about you.
oh, really? Yeah, I mean, I lived in different parts of Pennsylvania mostly.
I had no idea.
Yeah. For a while. But, yeah, so. But yeah, I've kind of lost taste for it.
Yeah.
For the culture around it and stuff. It
M
was kind of.
m me too. At first, it was a matter of time because the kids were born. And there just wasn't any time to be just sitting down to watch a 3-hour football game. There just wasn't time. But then as they've gotten older, and we honestly we could do that now if we wanted to, but I don't have the desire anymore. It's a lot like you said. It's like the whole culture behind it. I don't know. This is getting way off. Like, we don't need to be discussing all this stuff, but I don't know how it's sustainable. Like, what everyone knows about the, what happens to you, after you're, or even during, while you're playing the game or after.
Yeah, there's
But
a lot of things about it that feel kind of distasteful to me.
yeah, and the people are making so much money, and I don't mean the players, I mean like the actual corporation and the owners and stuff, and it's like, I don't know, it feels kind of gross now. But whatever.
But yeah, but you, other than that, you had a good holiday?
Yeah, it was nice. Like I said, it wasn't a huge number of people, which is nice. This is what it usually is. Because, like I said, my brother and his family go to his wife's side on Thanksgiving. So, yeah, it was really nice. It was relaxing. And we really haven't done a whole lot this whole weekend. But it was, it's been nice. Couple weekends ago, get into like kind of comic book talk. James Tynion IV was at Pulp 716. They have two loca- Are you familiar with them? They've got two locations in north of Buffalo, one in Lockport and the other one, I think, in North Tonawanda.
Yeah, I've never been to them, but they're supposed to be nice
Yeah, so
shops.
it's like a it's a coffee. They specialize in coffee and bubble teas, and then of course all like the comic book stuff. And
Yeah.
what's interesting is it's owned by a woman and almost 100% staffed by women as well. So it definitely it has like a totally different vibe than if you go to like a typical comic book store, like a Queen City, which is an old fashioned comic book store, where even to this day it's unusual to see a woman walk into the store. This is totally the opposite. It's very they have like tables and chairs, and you can order your drinks. They have different types of games. That you could just pull off the shelf and just sit and drink coffee or tea and play games. But they carry all like new releases, pretty much any comic book that's a new release you could buy. They don't really have any type of back stock like you would think of, like an older comic book shop. Any of their back issues is probably no more than a couple years old. But anyhow, I think it might be the owner, or maybe it's just one of the managers of the one of the stores, but she really took to this Boom comic that James Tynion is writing called Something Is Killing the Children, and she like cosplays and looks exactly like the main heroine. So constantly promoting it, constantly promoting it. So James Tynion actually noticed that and reached out to the store and asked if he could come and do a signing.
That's
I'm
funny.
like, yeah, I'm like, oh my God, it was really cool. So we went there and we met him, and I got like one of the one of the variant covers of number one, and had him sign that, and had him sign my Rebirth Detective Comics hardcover that I have, because he was writing that when Rebirth launched, and he's going to be taking over Batman. So it was cool to actually see some, you know, like a, because, you know, he really has gotten to be a big time writer, to actually notice like this, you know, just little comic shop here in Buffalo, they promote so much, and like him to reach out to them and say, you know, let's set something up. That was really cool of him. And it seemed to have a really good time while he was here. So yeah, it was nice.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty cool. I think there was something I was going to ask you. I don't remember what it was now. Oh, I remember. Now, Chris, do you play some form of Dungeons and Dragons?
I have gotten curious about it again the last few months. So I haven't really played any live games. I have started messing around a little bit with what they call play by post, which is basically really slow text based.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah,
I remember years ago people used to play in the mail, but
I guess that's kind of, I mean, that might, maybe that's like, it's an evolution of that, but it's just based on like forums, and
oh, gotcha.
You know, the forums have a way to you just put in particular code.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like simple forum code, where like you would do like a B in brackets, like it's like simple HTML. I think it's like, I forget what the name of the type of code is for forum, and then they have that, you use that for dice rolls and stuff. So that's been an interesting way to explore it.
The reason why I ask is that, I mean, I haven't really been able to play since I was an early teenager.
Yeah.
Maybe not even then. I might have been 12. But if you end up pursuing that and doing anything, please keep me in mind, because I would love to actually get back into it. I actually put the player's handbook in that, in one of the setting things on my Christmas list this year, just to... I seem to buy a lot of the versions and read the books and then put them away and never do anything with them, because there's just like no one that I know that plays.
Yeah.
But yeah, keep me in mind if you end up pursuing it at all.
Yeah, that's cool. What was your history? What did you play back in the day? What?
It was very, very early. It was the original Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, and also that old boxed like basic set, I think. Yeah. Probably was the first thing that I bought, and then the old Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, the first one. But very soon after, I'm not even sure that we necessarily played, I think most of what we played was the second edition, but it was very hit or miss. It was just like with a handful of kids in the neighborhood that had very different levels of interest.
Yeah.
So we tried that on and off, but I mean, it never was a very intense thing. It was, you know, I mean, we were all young. We, you know, if we all got together to do even four times for like one continuous setting or continuous characters, that probably was a lot. It was constant, like dipping your toe in, and then somebody, you know, you'd start to play, and then two out of the four people, two out of the five people aren't interested to continue anymore, and then you're kind of stuck, you know what I mean? So it wasn't, there wasn't a lot to it, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you?
So I guess I was a little more into it my mostly preteen, early teen time period. So it wasn't for a super long period of time, but But I definitely got a lot of the books. I had I don't know, a decent amount of, I knew a decent amount of people that were into some of the different systems. We mostly played the second edition of Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. I remember I'd occasionally find or get a first edition book and look at it with a lot of amazement and curiosity, because it seemed so archaic and different. And now people look back probably on second edition and feel the same way, because it's actually they're on fifth edition now.
As I put on my list. You wouldn't believe, I mean, between the first and second edition especially. I mean, I had a ton of first edition stuff. I bought like a crap load of stuff, but like the amount that I actually ended up being able to use or play, it probably is like the least amount of like whatever you call like getting your money's worth of anything that I've ever bought in my life. I mean, I had so much stuff, but it was barely used. It was I mean, it was just a function of not having enough people to really be interested. Usually, if we did play, there was a kid across the street, and then my little brother, who wasn't really all that into it, but being a kid that's like 3 years younger than the other two, you kind of get forced into doing like stuff, right? So I mean, it was like me like being in charge, which I didn't necessarily want to do, but then each one of my brother and the friend across the street, each being two characters just to have a decent party. And that was pretty much it.
We dabbled in some other systems too. I mean, I did know, because one of my friends, I had an older brother who was probably like 4 or 5 years older than us, maybe like a junior or senior in college, and he had a group of friends that were into it. So if we would get to play with a couple of them sometimes, it seemed really awesome, because by comparison to one of us, if one of them was the dungeon master, they seemed 1,000 times better than us.
I know.
Just
I hear
by virtue probably of those 4 or 5 years. But I do remember trying to run games, and I was friends with two brothers, and that were like 2 years apart. And especially when the younger brother would run a game, the older brother was constantly like picking holes in whatever he had set up, and it would inevitably like dissolve into an argument between the two of them. But I mean, we had fun, and I did actually, it's kind of strange to me now that I was allowed to do this, but I did go with some of those older kids. I mean, to me they seemed like adults at the time, but up to Toronto overnight for a gaming convention. And what was interesting about that is that we ended up discovering Magic the Gathering when we were up there, which hadn't actually made it to our area yet. It was really, really early on in that game, and so we brought that back with us, and I showed it to some of my friends around here, and for the brief time that we were still interested in anything like that, it pretty much killed our Dungeons and Dragons. We just pretty much, like, after that, we just pretty much played Magic the Gathering,
That's funny.
and then got into high school and kind of lost interest in doing anything like that for a while. But so yeah, it's interesting. I've been kind of like so speaking of Magic the Gathering, the company that owns that game, Wizards of the Coast, they're owned, I think, by Hasbro, but they also own Dungeons and Dragons now.
Yes, they bought it from TSR years ago.
Yeah, so TSR, that was the company we were familiar with when we were young. And so they put out the third edition of Dungeons and Dragons, and then not sometime after that a three what they called 3.5, because they I guess fixed a lot of issues with it. And then when they came out with around the time that they came out with the fourth edition, that was the only other time I prior to recently that I kind of just sort of dipped my toe in to see what was going on, and I played one session of fourth edition like through a local meetup group. I went to, I think it was at, I don't think I they don't do it there anymore, but I think I'm pretty sure it was on UB campus.
Oh, okay.
I did that
They
one
might
time.
do it again now. It's gotten huge.
Yeah, I mean, I know there is stuff in the area for fifth edition. There's a lot, actually a lot of what they call Adventurers League. And it's like a formalized pick up and play kind of thing that you can host events at gaming shops or really wherever, and it's all formalized so that people can bring a character from one game to another game, and
Oh, interesting.
it keeps like there's limits on how much everything gets reported online, and there's limits on how much magical items you can get and everything like that. So like the characters stay within similar power levels of each other and stuff. But yeah, getting back to so that this when I went to play fourth edition Dungeons and Dragons, it was kind of a similar like earlier version of that. And what happened around that time is that a company that didn't really like the changes to fourth edition
Pathfinder.
started Pathfinder.
Ah, see, I knew where you're going now.
I just all I knew about that was that somebody that night explained to me, because there was a group that was also playing Pathfinder, and they were like, yeah, Pathfinder's kind of a continuation of 3.5 edition, and it's kind of like they didn't really like the changes of fourth edition. And I actually also didn't like when I so I played fourth edition, and I was like, this is kind of weird. Like it felt like it was trying really hard to be trying way too hard to appeal to people who played like World of Warcraft and stuff.
Was that the one where it was became very much? I don't want to say that it was exactly the same, but was fourth, because I'm getting them confused largely because haven't been able to play them. But was fourth edition the one that really almost started to sound like a tabletop game?
Like
Or no?
meaning a board game or
Yeah.
yeah, because people call them like tabletop RPGs
Oh yeah, no,
nowadays.
I mean more like a like that, you know, you move this many spaces and you can do this and you can do there was one of them that was
I think
really
there,
kind of. Go
yeah,
ahead.
I don't know. I think there was a fair amount of that in there. I'm not really sure because I'm, like I said, I briefly played fourth edition and I only know. I remember second edition a lot from when I was a kid, and then I'm kind of aware, I kind of know fifth edition now. My
Gotcha.
knowledge of the stuff in between is really
Yeah, not so. Yeah.
but yeah, I mean and I but I think also in Pathfinder, like using a map and using miniatures is pretty big.
You know what? It might actually be third edition that I'm thinking of. It struck me that it was a lot less using your imagination and actually needing to visualize exactly where, specifically where you are on a map.
Yeah, there that kind of I think that was definitely a thing in the third edition Pathfinder era as well. I think in fifth edition it's kind of like a an optional thing. to use a map and stuff, which I'm still kind of figuring out where my preferences lie and stuff, but I can kind of see the advantage of having a combination of the two.
Yeah, no, I didn't have it. It struck me because it was much different than what I remembered the earlier editions, first and second being. But that's not to say that, because the only other time that I got into it, and I think it was third edition, is that through, I think I've talked about City of Heroes before, right? The online game. Through City of Heroes, a couple guys actually played in real world Dungeons and Dragons, and they offered to with me and I think there was two others to set up an actually an online game, and like you know there was an actual like host program that you could you know a free program that you could download, and it would ha it, they he could input a map and stuff like that, so you could see where you were. So that was it was fun while it lasted. But it just, you know, very hard with people all in different areas of the country and stuff, and trying to, you know, set up a consistent weekly time frame. It just didn't end up working for more than probably a couple months.
Yeah, I've looked into that somewhat. It's interesting how much of an online presence there is now. I mean, there's multiple programs like you're talking about. It's like they actually compete with each other. There's enough of them. And that seems like it could be an interesting way to get into it more. But yeah, I mean, to wrap up, I did kind of start looking in. I've looked into and played a little of fifth edition, and I've also been getting into the Pathfinder Second Edition, which just came out in like about 4 months ago or so.
Oh, really?
Which is yeah, kind of an interesting. Whereas fifth edition, I think, came out maybe like 5 years ago or something.
I didn't re even realize that's like the only edition that I hadn't bought. So now, like I said, I put it on my list. So
What's that?
the fifth edition. Yeah.
Yeah, fifth edition, and yeah, I wasn't really paying attention for a while there myself. Didn't realize that it had been out so long, but yeah, like you said, it's become really popular. It seems almost maybe the most popular Dungeons and Dragons has ever been.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, there's
Since probably the 80s when,
yeah,
you know, worship the
definitely
devil if you played.
definitely that. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of attention on it because there's a lot of like celebrities that play, and a lot of like YouTube and Twitch series and stuff that people watch. And
Have you watched any of those?
I've watched a little, I've watched a little of a couple newer ones that are promoting the new edition of Pathfinder.
I've thought about either watching some or even there's podcasts where, and I've thought about doing one or the other, but it's just as much as I think I'd be interested in at least trying one or the other out to watch slash listen, it's just I just haven't found the time, especially like this, they're typically kind of long too, you know, at least a couple hours, so just haven't had the time to do it. Yeah, I'd love to at some point, but.
Yeah, it takes a little while. Might take a little while to find one you like or figure out what system you're interested in hearing somebody play and that kind of thing. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I also think I always have a tendency to kind of gravitate towards the underdog and that kind of thing. And so even though I was my interest was kind of initially awoken by the fact that I kept seeing Dungeons and Dragons everywhere all of a sudden, the fact that it does have like the celebrity support and all that kind of attention can be a little bit of a turnoff to me.
I see, yeah.
just because of my personality, but it's a good system from what I've seen of it. It's pretty easy to pick up and play, and it's pretty easy to learn. I'm still kind of deciding whether I find it to be too simple, or if it's just right. Whereas Pathfinder 2 seems to not be as bogged down in rules as what it sounds like the original Pathfinder was, but maybe has a little bit more complexity to it, which might be an appealing thing. But like I said, it's all. I don't know that my opinions have had enough time to solidify yet, And I've only, like I said, tried it. Like, I've only. Anything I've played has just been through play by post, which again is it's like playing on the forums, and it's real slow paced because of that.
Sure. I just had one other question I wanted to ask you. We kind of got into it for a second, but what were there any other back in the day, were there any other games aside from the Dungeons and Dragons that you tried or bought? I know from myself, especially in the heyday of Dungeons and Dragons in that early 80s time, I basically bought every other TSR game that they had. So I bought Star Frontiers. I think we played that once or twice. Gamma World, I absolutely fell in love with. That was like a post-apocalyptic game. And we did play that actually. I would venture to say I played that as much as Dungeons and Dragons. And then I also bought, there was an espionage spy game called Top Secret, which I
Oh, yeah.
played but never, I'm sorry, I bought but never played. I also had a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles role-playing game where you can create your own mutant animals.
Oh, yeah, I had that. I don't know
Yeah, I
if I
bought
ever
that,
actually
but I never
played it.
played it.
I created like probably 50 characters though for
Yeah,
that,
it
because I
was
just loved.
tons of fun to build those characters.
Yeah, the characters were, because they had rules for so many different types of animals and stuff.
Yeah. And then the other one, and I think I might have discussed it on here before, is Villains and Vigilantes, which, is the superhero version of Dungeons and Dragons. It had its own, it's still a die 20 game and stuff, but it had its own set of rules. But the point of that is you, like, if you're a player, you literally played as yourself, but now you've gained superpowers. So we played that quite a bit, and I think I played that more often than any of the other games, including Dungeons and Dragons. But what about you, other than that Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? Did you try anything else, or that was about it?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Nothing as much as D&D. But I look back and all the stuff that I bought and that my friends bought, it's like, where did I guess I had a pretty steady allowance, because I don't know where I got the money for all this stuff. And
Same here.
I must have
Same here.
asked.
I'm like, these books were like, even back then, $20 or $30 each.
Yeah, I guess I must have asked for them a lot for presents and stuff too, or something. But like, in fact, I know I did, especially some of the like D&D box sets and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, I remember we did a little bit of. So anything else that we did actually play, I think it was only maybe just a few times. But I remember my one friend was particularly looking into other types of games, and we did Shadowrun
Oh, I remember
a
hearing about
little
that one.
bit. Was like that's like cyberpunk, which is still around today, but apparently the new edition of it is people don't like it. But we did some of the White Wolf games, like
Was that the vampire thing?
Vampire Masquerade, where they had like a werewolf one and a couple other ones. Rifts,
I remember that. I
which
never tried that.
that was by the same, well, at least put out by the same company, I think, as the Ninja Turtles one, Palladium or something
Oh,
like
yeah,
that.
okay.
But that was again like also like a futuristic, really weird setting. I don't know if I ever actually played a session or just like made characters and my one friend was really into like making characters and stuff like that, but they were super overpowered and stuff, I recall. But yeah, I know I had some GURPS books, which was like a generic role-playing system. I do remember Gamma World. I
God,
think
I
I might
loved
have had
Gamma
a
World.
Gamma World box set or something like that.
Yes, yeah, I had
Yeah.
the box set. I went back and some of my earliest eBay purchases, and when I say that, I'm talking like 1998, 1999, were the old, because at this point, there was no Gamma World, because this was in the mid 80s that Gamma World was around. I managed to find on eBay and bought, like, I had a couple of the modules, and it was like one long story. There might have been, I don't remember if it was four or five or six modules that told like a story. And I had like three of them, and I managed to go on eBay and I managed to find the other ones, and so I own them all. Again, not that I've ever used any but the first module, but I do own them all.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, there's a lot of enjoyment just to be had in reading this content too.
There is, but for me personally, there's a large amount of frustration as well, because it was and that's, it had grown over time. I wasn't originally frustrated, but then it became like, why am I buying this and reading this? I'm never going to be able to play this game, and just start to get upset.
And as an adult now, I'm conscious of that, so it's easier for me to, as an adult, to say, okay, I'm gonna be careful about the investment I make. You know, I'm gonna look for deals, and I'm gonna proceed slowly. Because one, I don't know. It's one, I'm exploring the idea, and two, I know my own tendency to switch around and move from one thing to another, and when it comes to my interests. So
Yeah, I
we'll
mean
see
it.
how it
Well,
goes.
it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm kind of the same way. In the past, I would just buy like the set of the three core like Dungeons and Dragons books or something like that. But like I'm not doing that. I'll check out the Player's Handbook or something like that and just read it. Like you said, I'm not gonna get all into the
Yeah, you can
stuffs.
even, I can send you the link later, but you can even read the, check out the basic rules for 5th edition for free
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah,
online. It's like,
that'd be interesting.
yeah, it's like 100 or something pages. It has everything you need to play, basically. It just has less options, so it only has like four races, four classes, and
But
then.
it still gives you a nice idea whether or not, what
Yeah, it's
or what you
everything you
think about
need.
it. It gives you some information, yeah.
Basically, the player's handbook, in addition to this, just gives you more options.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we can continue the conversation, and we can talk some more about it. 'Cause the one thing that I found appealing about the play-by-post is it's easier. It's more comfortable for me when it comes to, not knowing anybody.
I'm laughing because that's exactly my thing, is that I can easily now, I mean, as nice as that this is, we have a couple gaming stores right nearby now. I know that the one closest to me, I know they have a Dungeons and Dragons night. I don't know who any of these people are, and I'm freaking almost 50 years old. I'm 47. I don't need to make any new friends. Well, it's not really that though, Chris. It's just it's not really that. It's just I don't know. It's just it gets if that if there's not if you're not I don't know how to say this. if it's just an awkward, like if the other per, if the other people or some of them are awkward or whatever, you just don't have that, you're not gelling. It's just weird or awkward. Like, how do you remove yourself out of that situation then?
Yeah. I mean, it's fine. I mean, like I know I'm an introvert. You know, I'm not, which doesn't mean that I'm socially. I don't have a phobia about like socializing, but I am an introvert. You know, mm-hmm. It's socializing is something I like and need to do, but it drains me. You know,
yeah.
It depletes my batteries, and to recharge those batteries, I need to be away from people.
Yeah.
And so I could do it, but yeah, I'm not exactly rushing out the door, even though there are a lot of opportunities to just go to one of these events and play with strangers.
Yeah.
And like I said, I mean, like I'm not, it's not that I necessarily don't want to play with a broader age group, but it is the idea of playing with people closer to my age is more appealing to me. You know, so I'm kind of have been laying back and seeing how things go and seeing if I get to know anybody or if
yeah.
something maybe eventually turns into something. So we can talk some more.
Yeah. Keep me in mind,
yeah.
For sure. If something comes up or whatever, and you know, I'd like to dip my toe in it again, whether it's ends up being the Pathfinder or the actual fifth edition or whatever. Yeah. Just keep me in mind.
Yeah. We can always try both. See what you
yep.
like, and see if we can find another couple folks, whether it's, even if it's online, you know, even though we have the proximity, if we need to do the online for
yeah
to have a few other people involved or something. So
worst case scenario, about 6 years, Zach will be 12. I'm sure he'll be into it.
Yeah. So yeah, we just wait till he's old enough.
Anyhow, so that was
a big tangent, but I
definitely wanted to discuss with you because I know that's something that you had been interested in, and then I think I saw a post or something that you had, and I know that Mike's not interested in it, so this was the perfect time to talk about it, and hopefully we didn't bore everyone listening.
Yeah, Mike, maybe I could put a note, like, skip to skip to this time if you want to, but I don't think all of our audience is as hostile to Dungeons and Dragons as Mike is for.
No, I don't. No, I don't think so.
Some strange. It is definitely a nerdy topic, but it's one of those ones that Mike has on his list that he's not interested in.
Yeah.
You never know, though. I mean, I saw he's reading some manga lately.
Yeah. What the hell?
That was one of his never.
Yep.
Never gonna happen things, and next thing you know, he's gonna be like watching Doctor Who and playing D&D.
That's right. You might be doing all three at the same time.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there is a Doctor Who role playing game.
Yeah, probably.
I don't know exactly how that works, but I guess nobody gets to be the
the Doctor.
Yeah, which sounds
kind of
boring.
We did go to Pulp 716. Yeah, it was yesterday, and Zach bought himself a Pokemon. They're like, you know, little like trade paperback, you know, but they're all manga. So we're like, Zach, is this gonna get you messed up because you have to read from the back, you know, to the front, you know, basically the exact opposite. He's like, no. And then this morning he was looking at the book and he had it face like open like the Western way. Mm. I'm like, Zach, you know you're looking at the end of the book. It's like, no, I'm not. He thought I was teasing him. Like, I'm not. I'm like, no, turn it. Remember, we told you this. And then I turned the couple pages in the actual front, and I said, see, here's the table of contents. He just like looked at me. He was stunned. I go, remember we talked? Oh yeah, I remember now. So yeah, it is weird to try to read something like that. I tried to read to him a couple times and it messes me up.
Yeah, I mean, like right when you start it, it's a little weird at first, but I don't know if it was last year or the year before. It was last year. I was watching a bunch of anime, and then that led to me reading a bunch of manga. And after a short period of time, I didn't even think about it anymore.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, it just almost seemed normal to me. Like, why wouldn't you start at the back? So, it's just what you're used to, I think. It's not that weird once you get used to it.
Yeah, true.
But yeah, that was, I haven't read any manga in any time recently.
No.
It's one of
Yeah.
those things. I never know, like, I never know when the cycle's gonna turn around on me. I never know if it's gonna come back or when it's gonna come back, but at least I know that that happens to me. Like when I was younger, it's been like this my whole life, and when I was younger, I'd be convinced that I'm out of this for good. Like I have no interest left. I'm not into like video games anymore or whatever it is, you know, I'm done. It's never coming back, and sell everything, and then a couple years later,
You're like
like,
crap.
oh, you know what? I feel like playing a video game. But so now I'm a little more it helps to be aware of that aspect.
Yeah, for sure.
So.
I've been playing PlayStation 3. Now that the kids are a
Oh.
little older, because they now can play as well. So, and I was playing the first Lego Batman game from PlayStation 3.
Oh yeah, those are
Yeah,
fun.
so I'm almost done with the first Batman, and I actually have the unopened Batman 2, like the DC superheroes Legos. So I'll be playing that one as soon as I finish up the first one. But
Are you
yeah,
playing it by yourself, or are you guys doing?
I'll typically play by myself, but if you know, like if Zach, typically it's Zach. Allie rarely plays the games, but every once in a while he'll play, or I'll just play by myself on my game. But then when he wants to play, I'll join him. That's what we usually do.
Yeah, 'cause those Lego games, those are pretty easy to have somebody just play along with
Yes.
you, right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think now, like, there's almost certain games that you can tell they're designed for parents with younger kids,
Yeah.
'cause they almost like they make it easy for a second player to jump in and mess around and not be responsible really
Oh,
for,
that's exactly right.
yeah,
Yeah.
advancing things and stuff. So it's like now that like a generation of people who grew up with video games have kids, you see these games that are clearly designed to accommodate that kind of a scenario.
It's so true. And like you said, just today, Zach, I was still upstairs. I hadn't really gotten up yet, and Zach, of course, they're already awake, so we allow them basically an hour of screen time in the morning and in the afternoon on weekends or days off. So they're already, downstairs playing their screen time, and Zach is playing Lego Batman, and he comes upstairs and he's like, I can't remember what I can't get this one special thing. And so I said, all right. So I went downstairs, just like you said, jumped on just for this one screen, helped him get it, and then I went back upstairs, logged back out, and he got playing. It's perfect. Yeah, it
That's
is.
another way that works too.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's cool. Yeah, it's funny. Our friends of ours have a son who's, I don't know, maybe around the similar age to him. And I saw him, he found out that I knew about video games and stuff, and he was just, I was instantly became his best buddy. He was just really into the whole idea of like being a gamer, and just he had this like book of video game facts that he wanted to look at with me, and he kept asking me like, "Have you heard of this game? Have you heard of this game?" And you know, like there was that curiosity about games that he's like, "Do you have a?" He was asking me like, what systems I have and stuff, and he's like, I want a Nintendo Switch, but I already have an Xbox, and my parents say it's ridiculous to have more than one video game system. I was like, well, it's rough having parents.
You're literally his new hero.
Yeah. It's like when you get older and you have your own money, you can buy as many things, as many systems as you want.
Exactly. That's pretty cool.
You gotta hold out like another decade and a half.
They'll get there.
Yeah, but the reason I thought of him was because I think he plays a lot of those Lego games because they're, age
They're just,
appropriate and stuff, but
yeah, and
they're.
they're like, they're somewhat, I mean, they're not hugely challenging, but they're just challenging enough, like, for me as an adult to enjoy it. But also, I don't have to sit there and really, really, really concentrate. I can quite kind of just sit back and relax,
Yeah.
and that makes it. It's just something nice to be able to just sit down and do for, like a half an hour, an hour, and not have to really bang your head against the wall trying to figure something out. Which is something that it's good for me at this stage. When they get a little bit bigger, I'm sure I'll be into other, I'll help them with harder stuff, but yeah.
Yeah, I think well, that's like regular Legos. They definitely add a lot of details and characters and things like that that would jump out to somebody that knows whatever franchise it is,
Oh yeah.
and maybe not necessarily gonna mean anything or stand out to kids,
Yep.
and they don't care, but like if you're an adult and know DC and stuff, they put some more obscure characters in there and stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, well, I guess speaking of DC,
Oh,
I
you
guess we
got
could
something
actually
for
talk
us?
about some comic books here.
Why not? Why
Why
not?
not? Yeah, I mean, I read all DC again, so I can talk about something.
Yeah, go ahead. I actually have to say I haven't had had very little chance to do a lot of reading lately, but I have a handful of movies to talk about this time around.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, but go ahead.
Well, let's see. Where were we here? So, this is The Question, number 7. So this is from the 80s, the Denny O'Neil series, and Dennis Cohen, on art. And it's a story called Survivor, it's primarily about this one character who looks a lot like Wolverine. Like, I don't know if it's intentional. It almost seems like it kind of is intentional. It starts out with a splash page of him. Kind of like a jungle man sort of thing, where he's in the jungle or the woods or something like that, and he's naked, eating from a, I assume, freshly killed deer. And then the next page is a 9-panel grid, which is really kind of neat, where it's that same scene for a couple panels, and it flips back and forth between it being him naked and it being a wolf. And then it's that same scene, but he's clothed. And then it's a close-up on the wolf, and it has a scar over its left eye, and that eye is missing. And then it's a close-up on him clothed, and then the last row is the background changes, and he it transitions into him in his clothes with a tie, eating meat at an actual table with, you know, knife and fork and stuff. So it's an interesting introduction, and then we have a better sense of place as we go on to the next page that he's actually dining somewhere with a nice spread out in front of him by himself, and he's addressed by a waiter or some sort of employee there as Mr. Volk. Asked if he's all right, and then someone comes in from the foreground. A blonde man pulls a gun out of his coat, and Volk grabs the carafe of coffee on the table and splashes it on his face. Jumps up and throws the guy through the window. So the next scene is takes place at the mayor's office, and the mayor is a recurring character. Mayor Wesley, he's a mess, really. The scene and as the scene starts, he's totally drunk, and his wife, who was a former lover of Vic Sage, and I forget the exact circumstances, but she married the mayor while he was missing, I think, or I think when he was away, like doing his training in Tibet or wherever it was. It's they're talking about the fact that this Volk that we've just been introduced to is going to be coming for a meeting, and his wife is reminding him of this and explains that Volk runs the like an illegal gambling operation in Hub City. He's been doing that for almost 40 years, and they don't know the exact details of why he wants a meeting. But it sounds like maybe he's ready to get out of the game and retire and whatnot. So he shows up, the mayor's completely drunk, and Volk is totally unimpressed, and walks back out, and his wife goes running after him and says, you know, I can act in his name, and he won't talk to her. And so she goes back and calls Vic Sage. Meanwhile, we see that there's competition. Assumably, the whoever sent the guy that tried to kill Volk in the beginning of the issue are putting together some more men to send after him. And then the mayor's wife, Myra, is her name, has that meeting with Vic Sage, and they talk about their circumstances a bit, and she wants him to look into this Volk guy. You know, they talk a little bit about the fact that she was forced to marry the mayor. Like I said, I don't exactly remember the circumstances, but that was something that kind of was gone over in the earlier issues of this series, and they have feelings for each other and stuff still, but it's important to her to stand by her vows and whatnot. And so Vic reaches out to Volk as Vic Sage, and Volk's not interested in talking to a reporter, so he prepares to go out as the question. And he shows up as the question at folks' apartment. Well, he goes up the fire escape and he's outside the window, and before he can do anything, Vokes senses him and uses a whip. The whip smashes through the window and ties itself around the question's neck, and he actually pulls the question into his apartment by the neck. But question insists that he's not his enemy, and Volk can sense from his voice that he's not lying, so he backs off and decides to tell Question his story. And basically his background was he was from a family of gypsies in Romania, that lived in Russia for a decade. They were hounded by the communists there, and they decided to try to travel through Germany to get to Switzerland, and they were caught by Nazis. But they caught him, and they used his father's whip on him, and that's how he lost his eye. And he came to, he was still alive, and he was surrounded by wolves, and he thought they were gonna finish him off, but they ended up. So basically, he was raised by wolves. And he says, "My body left them, but never my spirit." But after the war, he came to America and did what he did to get to where he's at now, is running the gambling and whatnot. And basically, he's telling the question this. It's just as an opportunity to have somebody know his story. And at this point, he also explains the reason that he was going to Mayor Furman was that he's had dreams lately, and he's afraid that he's going insane, so he's disbanded his operations, and he was going to inform on his competitors, because they do, unlike him, they do what they do to survive, not to survive like he does, but to corrupt. But as he found out, the mayor, he felt that the mayor was also corrupt and weak. So the conversation's interrupted by the men that were sent after Volk, and he tells the question to take off, but question decides to stick around and help him fight off the men that are coming for him. And they take down the first wave, but excuse me.
Bless you.
I tried to hit the mute in time, but I didn't get it. But another couple guys come along, and Volk gets the last guy by the neck after using his whip to pull the Uzi out of the guy's hand. And we actually know this from earlier. There was a scene where this guy prepped his Uzi and his sidearm, so we actually know he's got another weapon. Volk doesn't. And Volk's got him by the throat, and the guy pulls his other weapon out and shoots Volk in the stomach, but not before he strangles the other guy. So he's dying. He tells the question that he says, "For years I was two bodies, one soul. Now I unite, I survive." And then he gives him the location of a tree shaped like a question mark in his country of origin. So Vic decides to go check it out, even turns down a job Because at this point, he's working just freelance as a reporter because of some of the things that have happened, and so he heads out, and he finds this tree, and in the dirt at the roots of the tree, there's a both a wolf's paw print and a V, the letter V, which he guesses might be for the name Volk, and then he looks behind him, and there's a wolf standing there that has the same scar over its eye that Volk does, the same missing eye. And that's the end. So that was a pretty neat single issue story. Just kind of like I said that Volk definitely kind of looks like Wolverine. It kind of has Wolverine's hair, but it wasn't in like a and like a like a if anything it was in a homage or sort of like O'Neill maybe had this idea or maybe it was Cohen to sort of tell a Wolverine story without Wolverine, you know, maybe, but or maybe it was just kind of worked and made sense for that look for a character that was part wolf, maybe, or it's hard to exactly, you know, it's left kind of ambiguous, but yeah, so far this, I've read them over a pretty broad stretch of time, but so far the question series is really strong.
That's what I wanted to ask you. So, have you only read these first few then so far, or
Yeah.
okay? But you've enjoyed them for the most part.
Yeah, they're really good.
'Cause I own issue one and two only, you know, when it was originally published, and at that point I'm like, it was probably a function of many different things in terms of being able to afford whatever, and for whatever reason I didn't continue with them. So I wonder now that I'm, you know, older and probably maybe can appreciate these stories a little bit more than just simple, you know, more simple stories. I wonder if I should revisit
Yeah, I
the
mean,
question.
if you read those two issues, you'll know if you want to get more. And I mean, at least the next four or so, you definitely would like if you like those. And I would imagine as long as the creative team is the same, which I'm not sure how long they lasted. But yeah, I don't.
I was actually looking, and except for some fill-in issues. Well, first, Denny O'Neil wrote every single one, and except for a handful of fill-in issues, Dennis Cohen drew every single one, including the issue 37, which came out 20 years later as part of a Blackest Night tie-in.
Oh, was that one of the Blackest Night ones?
Yeah, so Denny O'Neil and Greg Rucka both wrote it, and Dennis Cohen drew it 20 years later. So that's kind of cool.
It's funny they when they I know that I know there's a Starman was one of the other ones they did that with.
Yes, that's one
But
too.
yeah, well then yeah, I kind of thought that was the case, but I expect it to continue to be good. But I don't think, yeah, I don't think back when it came out when I was younger, I don't think it would appeal to me as, because
I
just
was
my tastes
just,
were different.
yeah, I think I was just between the price, which I think was a little bit more than the comic books of the time, well, though I could be wrong, as well as just it wasn't, you know, mainstream superhero. I mean, it was a superhero comic book, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't a Batman, Superman, Spider-Man type thing. I just, it wasn't even a Blue Beetle, you know what I mean? So I think I just wasn't the right age for it.
It's just only just barely like outside of just a regular like detective kind of martial arts adventure kind of thing. I mean, because of the mask that he used, but it's really hardly even, it just makes his face blank, you know. It's more of like, it definitely has more of like a, its roots into like a like pulp adventure kind of thing,
Oh, for sure.
which today really appeals to me, but when I was a kid, I don't think it would have that
Right.
much.
Right, exactly. So as I said, I've got some movies I can discuss, and the first one is probably not one that we normally talk about on the show, but I'll briefly cover it nonetheless. This past week, I rewatched, or for the first time in many years, Pete's Dragon from 1977. Have you ever seen
Oh.
this movie, Chris? I know you're younger than I, so I don't know that you've ever gone back to see this movie.
Yeah, it's hard. It's one of those things where I'm not sure if I did or if I'm just aware of it from,
Yeah.
like, through pop culture.
So I would have been the age, to see this movie, and especially, I'm assuming, it was on HBO afterwards. I would have been 6, 7, so. Or it was right in my, the right age for it. So, I'm not aware of the, I don't know this director. It's the director was John or Don Chaffee, but some of the stars was Helen Reddy was the main woman in the movie. Her dad was played by Mickey Rooney. Some other ones, Shelley Winters was the main. The matriarch of the villain family, and Red Buttons was the sidekick to like a snake oil type salesman, because this is definitely set like in not in present day. It probably I don't know when that was. Probably the late 1800s, I would guess. But anyhow, there's this boy named Pete, and he. And I should mention also, this is a musical. So, as a little kid, I had the actual record that I would play a lot. So there's a boy named Pete that apparently had been sold to a family called the Gogans, and that's Shelley Winters, her husband, and two older sons that are very, very abusive and nasty. So Pete manages to escape. And it's apparent right away that he actually has like a protector, and you're not sure if it's imaginary or not, but an actual dragon that in the movie is animated, whereas everything else is live action. So he manages to escape with the help of the dragon named Elliot, and makes his way to this town. And incidentally, the mayor of the town is Jim Backus, who is Thurston Howell the third from Gilligan's Island. And so he befriends the daughter of the local lighthouse keeper, who is played by Helen Reddy, and she just assumes that the dragon is just his imaginary friend as a scared, lonely boy. And Mickey Rooney's character, Lampy, who is the lighthouse keeper, he actually had seen the dragon, but he was quite drunk at the time. There's a reoccurring theme here that he's constantly drunk. Definitely a different G-rated movie in 1977 than probably what you would have today, with many of the characters often getting drunk. And that's part of the humor. Probably wouldn't see that these days. But anyhow,
Yeah, drunks were like a joke,
yeah, it was
yeah.
there's a whole scene with Mickey Rooney and Red Buttons. He's taking Red Buttons to go see the dragon, and in order to kind of get their bravery up, they both get liquored up. And I mean, they're acting ridiculous, they're acting silly and stuff, and they go to the cave where the dragon is hiding, and they this whole thing is played up for laughs that they're totally inebriated, which is kind of funny. But anyhow, so the kid ends up hanging out, Pete ends up hanging out with Nora, who's the lighthouse keeper's daughter, and they they actually she's going to end up trying to adopt Pete. It turns out that she had been engaged to a man named Paul, who had, I don't know exactly why he was out at sea, but his boat was lost at sea. He's been gone for a year. She still pines for him, and Lampy, her dad, says that she just needs to get over it. It's obviously, that she's still waiting for him to come back, where he's, obviously has passed on. So Pete believes Nora and says that he's going to get Elliot to try to find Paul. So again, she thinks that this is just an imaginary a friend, and she just goes along with it. But finally, things kind of come to a head towards the end, where Jim Dale, I know the name and I know the face, and obviously I know him from this movie, but I don't know anything else that he's from. But he plays Dr. Terminus, who is the snake oil salesman. And when he finds out from his sidekick, Red Buttons, that the dragon is real, he has books of, like, what things you can make with different types of animals. And there's a whole thing with, like, that you can basically, the dragon is a gold mine. You can use all different parts of this dragon for all sorts of ailments. 'Cause up to this point, he's been just selling people. Like, he just puts random things in potions, and he sells them as if they're like miracle cures. And at the same time, the Gogans are nearly tracking down Pete. What happens is Elliot comes back and tells Pete that he's found Paul, and Paul is on his way back. And he tells Nora, and Nora doesn't believe it. But Dr. Terminus and the Gogans end up, they form a pact to work together, because Dr. Terminus wants the dragon and the Gogans want Pete back. So that all comes to a head just as Elliot had returned, and the entire town ends up, along with Elliot the dragon, and Nora and Pete and Lampy. They all end up working together, and not only run out the Gogans, but they manage to run out Dr. Terminus and his partner, who's played by Red Buttons. And then at the very end, you see Paul is sailing back, and there's a terrible, terrible storm that actually lightning had struck the lighthouse and actually broke the glass, and the rain got in and turned the pilot light out. So there's absolutely no way that he can't see that he's going to be sailing right into the rocks. So of course Elliot manages to get up to the lighthouse, and he breathes his fire and turns the pilot light back on just in the nick of time. And Paul returns, and he's reunited with Nora. You can see that this is going to become a family with Nora and Paul and Pete. And just before the end, Elliot tells, he doesn't talk, but Pete can understand his, like, different sounds. And he tells Pete that he has to go, and he's not coming back because there's another little boy somewhere that needs help. So that's the last, kind of the last scene. You see Pete, or Elliot rather, flying away, and like everyone else is on the ground waving, and then that's the end of the movie. So definitely a kid's movie. I don't necessarily recommend, Chris, if you haven't seen it, to just sit down and turn that on. But a lot of nostalgia on my part with seeing this movie. It's not the greatest movie by any stretch, but something that I remember as a little kid, so I still have some appreciation of it, more so than if you would just come in cold.
Right. Yeah. I'm almost positive that I did see it. Listening to you describe it, I think we would have probably rented it.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. Right. I mean, it would have been on VHS for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think even that scene where you talk about them being drunk, I think I might kind of That sounds kind of familiar.
Yeah. No, I was just gonna say that this one and the next one I'm gonna cover, we got the Disney Plus service, and we had the there's a D20, did I mention this already? There's a D23 membership that you can pay for, but there's also a free membership just that you can go on the site and like look at the forums, and it's a Disney fan cult basically. Well, about a month or so before the Disney Plus launched, I started seeing promotions saying that if you were a D23 member, even a free member as we were, you could go in and sign up, and if you paid for 2 years, you'd get the third year for free, and basically came to like I want to say like $3.24 a month. So that's what we did, and obviously with 2 6-year-olds, we're going to get a lot of use out of it, and obviously I am as well. I'm watching the Mandalorian, and I'll be watching the Marvel movies when those come out as well. But anyhow, I watched Pete's Dragon on Disney Plus, as well as the movie that I'll cover next.
Yeah, I didn't even know D23 was a thing.
Yeah, I learned about it a couple times ago coming back from Disney World, and I don't remember exactly how I found out, but it's definitely, I mean, we just have the free membership, so it really doesn't do anything for me. This is the first time that there was any type of like benefit to having this, and I probably have had it for almost probably about 8 years, I'd say. But that was a good deal, because we were gonna get it anyhow, and to get it for what turns out to be like $3 and change a month is fantastic.
Yeah, my niece is they definitely have their hooks in her too. They know how
It's
to get them young.
oh yeah, oh yeah, definitely so.
She's only 5, so it's obviously the younger stuff, but I'm pretty sure Minnie Mouse is a real like constant companion to her.
Yeah.
She's pretty into it. They took her earlier this year down to Disney World for the first time.
Oh, really? How old did you say she is? 5?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what we did with ours. We went last year, when they were 5. I didn't want them to be any younger than that. I figure it'd just be a lot more work and not as much bang for your buck, because they weren't gonna really be able to enjoy as much. But yeah,
They'll
5.
remember it. You want to like if you're gonna spend
Oh,
that
for
much
sure.
money, you want them to actually at least retain some of it.
Yeah, and it was I don't know how sound like she enjoyed it as well, but
Yeah.
yeah, they absolutely loved it. It was really the perfect the perfect starting age to go. I wouldn't have wanted to go any earlier than that for sure.
Yeah. Now, did you say the Marvel stuff's not on there yet, or?
Well, like the Marvel, like mo a lot of the Marvel movies are on there, but not any of the there's no original programs yet.
Oh, right. That they're planning some though, right?
Oh yeah, there seems like they're planning a whole lot. But I'm not even sure when the first of the Marvel shows even start. I know there's going to be the Falcon and Winter Soldier. There's going to be quite a few other ones. I think a Ms. Marvel, like the new Ms. Marvel, a She-Hulk. I can't remember what else. There's going to be quite a bit. But I don't know when the first one even launches. So right now it's just the Star Wars one, although there's going to be more of those, as well as there's some other original shows, like more for younger kids. And there's a real interesting one if you are a Disney World fan. There's an Imagineering documentary series, which I think there's 4 episodes out so far. We've watched the first two, but the first episode is Walt Disney creating Disneyland, and the second one is and it ends right when Walt Disney dies. I think he died a couple of years before Disney World was completed. So then the second one was all about finishing up and creating Disney World, which his older brother, you know, really took charge of after Walt died. He got that the whole Disney World actually set up. So that was really interesting, and I'm not sure what the next episode is, but it's a whole series. It's really, you know, if you're a fan of that type of stuff, it's a lot of it I already knew because I'd read a lot of stuff, but it gives you a lot of extra details that I never knew. So it's very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, we all know the main reason you got it, though, is so you can watch the X-Men animated series.
That's why. I know. I got it on my queue. I haven't started it yet, though. But I guess the whole thing's there.
I think so, yeah.
Yep. So maybe next time I could cover the first episode.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to do that when Mike's not here anyway.
No, not at all. So, no, he'd be very angry.
Yeah. All right, I'll cover another DC Comics comic book.
Please do.
The Vigilante.
Oh, I know The Vigilante.
Yeah, this is another... Well, I don't think Question is suggested for mature readers, but this, but it's skews towards that audience where this is specifically suggested for mature readers.
Mm-hmm.
Written by Paul Kupperberg, penciled by Todd Smith, with inks by Rick Bruchette. This is issue 46, and it introduces the character Black Thorn, a female vigilante, kind of a minor character, but she does show up later in the first Checkmate, which was also Kupperberg, and he carried a lot of characters over from Vigilante. So yeah, this series has gotten progressively darker, and Adrian Chase, the Vigilante, has really like been in a pretty dark place for a while now. Actually, I said 46, it's actually 45.
Oh, okay.
Is the issue. 46 is the continuation of it, which I'm trying to bring up here. So 45 introduces, and 46 is a continuation of the story, but 45 is the first appearance of this Blackthorn. And for a while things have gotten progressively darker for Adrian Chase, and this issue kind of, it's sort of like shows him coming out of the fog, at least briefly. So he's kind of come out of it a little bit, but maybe not permanently, but he's back with some of the people that he was cooperating with, Harry Stein, the cop, and then Colonel Vostok, who's actually from Doom Patrol originally.
Yeah, it sounds familiar to me, yeah.
the Negative Woman. So he had been cooperating with them in earlier issues, but he's kind of, and there was a whole storyline with the Peacemaker, and he's really kind of gone off the deep end a bit. So when the issue opens, Vostok is talking to the police chief, kind of talking him down because of everything that the Vigilante has done recently. Like Harry Stein says, shooting up Union Station, half the streets around the Capitol, then blowing up the Karak Embassy, plus you're still wanted on a load of federal warrants. And then so she's kind of trying to convince the police chief not to arrest the vigilante. And Adrian reflects on this a little bit. He says, even though it's been insane, he remembers and knows everything that he's done, but it was like he was inside of himself looking out and not able to care about anything, and he realizes that he was basically trying to kill himself. There's in the scope of the, in the run of this series up to this point, there's been two other time periods where someone else he's stepped back, and two other individuals have taken up the vigilante costume, and both of them got killed. And so he kind of compares him to that situation, like he was putting himself intentionally in and being reckless, knowing that there was a good chance that he'd also be killed in the same way as the other two men. Then in the prior issue, he ended up in a situation where he was holding a kid who had died from an overdose, and so at that point something snapped. He realized that he was didn't feel he didn't have that same desire to die. Vostok ends up coming into the room after she's done talking to the police chief, and she said that Peacemaker is going to be hospitalized and to receive psychiatric treatment, and that she's convinced them not to take the vigilante in, but he better lay low for a while. And I'm pretty sure they're in the DC area, 'cause Vostok's it's like a covert government operation. So he decides he's gonna head off to New York because he's been following news reports about this Blackthorn killer who's using like poisoned thorns to kill people. But he Chase has got like a real interesting morality where he's killed often, but always in battle, quote unquote, or when catching somebody in the act, and so he doesn't consider it murder. Just like a soldier might think of killing somebody in battle, whereas this Blackthorn is just killing criminals in cold blood, so to speak, which he considers to be murder. So he's got a problem with that and wants and decides he's gonna head off to New York to look into it, and Harry wants to go with him. He in the past has been like a sidekick to him, and he was but Volstagg tells him that he has to take her place at a police anti-terrorism seminar because of she's going to be busy with something else, and he's like not at all the type to do something like this, and he's like, "No way." And she said, "I'll give you my notes, and it's, mostly you're just gonna have to be shepherding our guests between lectures," and he's got no choice, basically. So the rest of the issue from there flips back and forth between it's mostly vigilante in New York, but it occasionally jumps back to Harry Stein trying to give a presentation on anti-terrorism, and he's not much of a public speaker. And it's funny, he's as he's doing this, there's a guy in the front row that is yawning. He like knocks over his coffee, on the guy next to him and almost gets in a fight with the guy that he spilled his coffee on. And similar antics continue throughout the issue with that. Meanwhile, Vigilante roughs up some people and, you know, does his kind of the typical investigation, like the vigilante beginning their investigation, like trying to roughen up some people and trying to shake some information out of somebody. But what's kind of different about this is that as he's about to interrogate the last person, all of a sudden, you know, he's holding him by the lapels, and all of a sudden the guy drops dead in his arms, and he realizes that he didn't hear a single thing and didn't sense that anyone was near him, but the Blackthorn shot a thorn into the guy's neck. So meanwhile, the guy that spilled the coffee in the front row is actually falls asleep, and Stein's says, "Hey, buddy, if my talk's keeping you from enjoying your nap, just say the word." And the guy wakes up and spills his papers all over the place. And Stein's like, "Why don't you at least pretend you're interested?" And the guy introduces himself as Sergeant Harvey Bullock, Gotham PD. And he's like, "Sorry, don't get me wrong, pal. I just ain't a sit-down kind of guy, you know. I belong on the streets." So Stein's like, "Oh, man." And he goes back to his lecture. I thought that was kind of funny to.
is.
I didn't realize it was Bullock at first either.
I like that.
Eventually, Blackthorn tracks Chase down. He's staying in like a safe house apartment, this like roach motel place, and a woman shows up at the door, says, "Abierto la puerta, Jose. Soy yo. Bebe Maria," and he's like, "Oh, it's just this woman looking for her boyfriend." And he opens the door. "Comete un error, señorita. No es una un persona." And then she says, "No mistake, Adrian, baby," and kicks the door in. And turns out to be Blackthorn, and he's shocked because he's been assuming that all this time that the Blackthorn was a man. And so she walks in, and he's just standing there in his tighty whities, she talks a little bit and then drops her top, and he's like, "You're a murderer. I wasn't looking for you because I'm horny." But then she comes on to him, and it doesn't take very long. He hasn't been with a woman since his wife was killed, and that was part of what kicked off like this whole vigilante thing in his life, was his family being killed. He wakes up the next morning and she's gone. It's kind of a complicated situation, but what's interesting is in between, like, I was kind of surprised. This is the first time that I can remember, like, this series was suggested for mature readers, but this was before Vertigo, and they do actually, like, there is nudity. They do show her topless, and I was surprised, because I don't think prior to this issue, I don't think there had been any nudity. I might be forgetting. Like I said, this was before Vertigo, so all they had was just the little suggestive and mature readers thing on the front. It's nicely played here, where they fall asleep in each other's arms, and then there's just like two panels of Stein's ongoing speech, where he said, "Well, I'm going to be turning you over to the psychiatrist in a little bit, and they're going to fill you in on the psychological profile of your average terrorist, show you some of the techniques these guys use to maintain their edge over victims." So it's just kind of like, it's kind of subtle, but it's like she comes in, hits on him, and they make love, and then there's intentionally this little interlude where he talks about terrorists using techniques, and then he wakes up the next morning and she's gone, you know. And so he heads out, try to catch her trail again. Meanwhile, there's some more antics with Bullock, spilling his papers all over the place and complaining about why they have to saddle him with all this crap. And it's to the point where Stein is done with his talk, and he's like, "Are you for real?" They have like an exchange, which it's kind of funny because Stein is like also kind of like the hard-nosed cop, which is why he was like kind of awkward in the speech and was not the first to. He didn't really want to do it, and as Bullock points out, he's actually got a stain on his tie. But Bullock is played as he's kind of like Bullock is often, but Bullock and this is played as being even more of a little bit of a buffoon, you know.
Oh yeah.
But it's interesting to see the two of them.
I mean, he was really played up as a very clumsy character in Batman, particularly pre-Crisis.
Yeah, and this is shortly after Crisis, so this is probably
Right.
just a similar. He's had different. I know he's had different characterizations over the years, as and this is kind of similar to that.
Yeah, I mean, even to start out with, he was not only very clumsy and I don't know if he was not necessarily inept, but just very always like knocking things over. But he was also very antagonistic at first. I think he was brought in by the mayor to try to get rid of Gordon. I just read that this past year, so it's like fresh in my head.
Yeah. So, as the issue continues, Vigilante and Blackthorn have another encounter on a rooftop where the Thorn is after. She takes out another villain, and they sort of they've got their guns pointed at each other and have like it actually reminded me of a Batman and Catwoman conversation, especially because they're on a rooftop. But if it was like if you took the two of them and Batman and Catwoman and dropped each one of their morals down several steps. So Vigilante's like the killer that only kills in battle, and she's the vigilante that just straight up kills no matter what, you know. But so they're having a similar conversation, but just from a lower moral standpoint, you might say. And they end up, you know, they end up kissing instead of shooting each other. But then she slugs him in the stomach, and it turns into a fight. You know, he starts to get the sense that she maybe is manipulating him somewhat, and he's not accustomed to, you know, that or she's using him for something, and that he's as much experience as that he's had with a lot of violence and that kind of stuff in recent years. He's not really had anyone try to mess with his heart. And so she ends up shooting him with a thorn, but it's just a nerve toxin to put him asleep for a little while, so she can take off. And he actually ends up found today, or found by the cops in that time on the roof, and they're pretty sure it's pretty surprised to find out that they've caught the vigilante, he's got quite the reputation by this point. And then the last page is Bullock is tagged along with Stein to buy a new tie. And Bullock is waiting while Stein's trying on a new suit, actually. Looking at a paper, he's talking, and Stein says, "Will you give your jaws a rest, Bullock?" And he said, "No, I'm fine." I don't know if he's looking at a paper or some dossiers, but yeah, he recognizes a spy that's in there, and says he ran into her in Gotham. She was working for the Russians then, and there's a picture of a woman. I don't know if he said because I think Blackthorne. She's her real name's Elizabeth Thorne, and she used to be, I think, FBI, but they're talking about how this woman's name is Katya and that she was in the KGB. So I'm not sure if that's a false lead and if or if that's supposed to be someone entirely different than than Blackthorne, but like I said, it continues into the next issue, and then she's one Harvey Stein and Blackthorne and stuff are characters that end up showing up in Paul Kupferberg's Checkmate, so. But yeah, it's an interesting series from a time, like I said, before Vertigo. That's actually pretty dark. I won't spoil it, but I do know how the series ends up, and Adrian Chase is a pretty tragic character.
Interesting. Yeah, I've read very little. I think I covered one of the first few issues a while back. But I think I've only read like the first, I don't know, maybe three issues.
Yeah, originally spun out of New Teen Titans, actually.
Marv Wolfman, yeah.
Marv Wolfman created a character is based on, not really based, not based on too much, but there was a vigilante, like a Western hero
You're
in the
right, yeah.
Golden Age, but it's just really kind of taken that name. But and then there's been new vigilantes since then. But yeah, he was originally and the series started out as being written by Marv Wolfman. So I don't think it started out as dark as it is at this point that I'm reading. But yeah, kind of a hidden gem, I guess.
Yeah, cool. All right, so the next one, the next movie that I have, also from Disney Plus. This one was 2 years after Pete's Dragon. It was 1979, and it's a little movie that held my imagination for years and years called The Black Hole. Have you ever seen this one?
That I don't think I have seen that one. But
Again,
yeah.
I'm not familiar with the director, Gary Nelson. But it has, I mean, it has Maximilian Schell, Anthony Perkins, Robert Forster, Ernest Borgnine, Roddy McDowall did the voice of one of the robots. Slim Pickens did the voice of another robot. I had quite a few names in this movie, and I did see this one in the theater when I was a kid. I also got a lot had a lot of the toys back then, the little action figures. They had action figures of the robots, most of the characters, and I think the only I still know for sure that I still have the action figure of the evil robot Maximilian. It's a big red robot, kind of scary looking. And so basically what this movie is about is there's a crew on a small spaceship, and they're just basically just doing research, and they're due to go back to Earth set sometime in the future. And what they end up finding is an abandoned ship just out beyond the event horizon of a black hole. And after doing some investigating with their own ship's computers, they identify the ship as one that had been tasked several years earlier. I don't remember if it was 20, 30 years ago in the past to for research and had never been heard from again. They end up flying around it, and eventually a tractor beam is activated and they're brought on board. So they start cautiously looking around the ship. It appears to be, for the most part, abandoned. And then this that robot that I was telling you about, Maximilian, he shows up, but then so does a human being. And this the basically the person that's still alive on the ship was one of the lead researchers, if not the lead researcher on the ship, named Dr. Reinhardt. And they start asking lots of questions because they thought that this ship had been lost and what is it doing and stuff. And basically, he had said that they had, because the ship had been recalled and to come back, and that order had been ignored, and they'd never seen the ship again. Dr. Reinhardt explains that they had some problems. They had suffered some damage. They were unable to reply. He decided to stay beyond, or stay behind rather, and so did the father of one of the female crew members that has just that was on the smaller ship just now, Dr. Kate McCrae. Her dad also decided to stay behind, and they sent the rest of the crew back, and he expresses surprise that none of the crew members had ever made it back to Earth. So he seems to be very evasive. Immediately, as even as a little kid, you can see that something's not quite right. The ship just seems weird. They all start investigating. I should actually mention that the crew members. Robert Forster is the captain of the ship. He's got a younger lieutenant. There's Dr. McCrae, the female scientist. Henry Booth is Ernest Borgnine, and he is actually a reporter that has joined. And then Dr. Durant is Anthony Perkins, and he's another scientist that's very interested in different aspects of space. Also is their robot. It's like a hovering small little robot named Vincent that is voiced by Roddy McDowall. So they start exploring the ship. They're supposed to stay in one spot, but they end up not listening to Dr. Reinhardt, and they start exploring. And like Henry Booth, Ernest Borgnine's character, ends up going into like a whole area where they're growing all sorts of vegetables, and it looks like that'll it's a lot of food, and it's only just the one, just Reinhardt's the only one left. So, but it looks like they're growing a lot of food. There's also seems to be these automatons that just basically wear robes and have like a glass, a mirrored faceplate. Don't talk. They don't really deviate from whatever their job is. They totally ignore if somebody's there or not. They just go about their whatever their task happens to be. There's also sentry robots that seem like security type robots, and then of course Maximilian, Vincent, our robot, encounters a very old version of his model, and he's Bob, Bob. And he starts telling Vincent about how you can't really trust what's going on here. And sooner or later, what they start to realize through exploration, and like they go through the crew's quarters, and all of their clothes and belongings and everything are still in their quarters, like nothing had been taken. So they finally end up discovering that all of those automatons are actually the crew members that have been like kind of like lobotomized, and are just going about their single tasks at the direction of Dr. Reinhardt and Maximilian. So just before this, Dr. Durant, who's played by Anthony Perkins, is just fascinated with Dr. Reinhardt. Dr. Reinhardt is going to explore the black hole, and that's why he's right there. He's actually has finished the research and finished doing what he needs to do for his own ship to actually go into and through the black hole. So his original plan for this crew that he brought on board is that he wants them to record all of the findings from him going into the black hole and what that looks like from the outside. Dr. Durant decides that he's going to stay with Dr. Reinhardt. But Kate McCrae gets a message from their own spaceship, from the crew there, saying the discovery of that the automatons are just crew members that he had killed. And so she confronts him, and he basically says, you know, they wouldn't listen. You know, he needs to explore this, and so he had to do what he needed to do. And she asks about her dad, and Dr. Reinhardt confirms that he's dead. And they insist, Kate and Dr. Durant insist that they have to leave, and he doesn't want them to, and he asks Maximilian to stop him. Maximilian pulls out one of his appendages. It's not really an arm or anything, but and it has like a whirling blade, and he ends up killing Dr. Durant. And I don't buy it, but Dr. Reinhardt acts as if he just wanted Maximilian to stop him, not kill anyone, and that he has no control over. And he whispers to like Kate, saying, "Help me. I'm afraid of Maximilian." I didn't buy that at all. I think that he was controlling him 100%. But so anyhow, they start the ship starts going into the black hole. They manage to rescue Kate with the help of Vincent and some of the other crew members. They get getting onto their own ship just as the larger ship of Dr. Reinhardt's goes into the black hole, but their own ship gets sucked into the black hole too. And this is when it gets very strange, because it's like psychedelic as they're going through the black hole, and then when it's assumed that they're in the black hole itself, it basically looks like it's hard to describe it. It looks like the basic version of like hell. There's like just cinders and rocks and fire, and Maximilian is just sitting on top of like a large like almost like a mountaintop. And then you see Dr. Reinhardt kind of spinning into Maximilian until you can just see his eyes looking through Maximilian's like eye plate. They continue on, and now all of a sudden you start seeing like stained glass lights, as if like you would see in church, and then wham, they're out of the black hole. And that's pretty much the end. I've actually, since I just watched this again for the first time in quite a while, actually went online and started to try to figure out if anyone quite knew what the intention was about what the black hole was. Is it as simple as that it's heaven and hell or whatever? But mm-hmm. No one seems to really understand what the director was exactly going for beyond that, if it's just that simple, or if there was a different meaning. But anyhow, not this is this this particular movie did not get the best critical reaction at the time, and I don't know that it's thought of very fondly after the fact. However, as I learned when I posted on Twitter about watching this, there seems to be a large group of people that are around my age that have very, very fond memories of this movie when they probably saw it when they were 10 or less, I would venture. And I absolutely love it. I loved the even when I was a kid, I just loved the idea of them coming to a strange, almost abandoned place and like exploring it and trying to figure out, okay, exactly what is going on here. And you could tell that there was a sinister undertone, but you didn't know exactly what was going on until the end. And it's always been fascinating to me. I absolutely loved it. You know, like I said, I bought all those, or I'm sure I didn't buy them. I probably got them for as gifts, all the action figures and stuff like that. But even now, as opposed to Beats Dragon, where it's like, yeah, you know, it's a little kid movie, I could take it or leave it. I could rewatch this at any point. I love this movie. I actually give it on IMDb. I actually give it a 9 out of 10. I'm not saying that it's worth a 9 out of 10, but for me personally, just with my history of it, I love it. If you've never seen it before, I highly doubt you would give it a 9 out of 10. But
yeah, I'm pretty sure. Then yeah, I don't think I've seen it, but I do know it by reputation. I've seen it mentioned at times as like a lesser known good movie, and like probably from other people, you know, around your age that have nostalgia for it.
Yeah, it's definitely I don't know. There was just something about it at the time, and obviously my age, but just that subject matter really, really was hit a sweet spot for me. Loved it. So, if you ever get a chance, sit down and watch it and see what you think as a fresh viewer. I'd be interested to see your honest thoughts about, okay, how enjoyable is this movie? Yeah. You know, from an adult perspective.
Yeah. Cool. Yep. Well, I guess I'll probably do a little quicker overview of this last one.
Sure, and then I've got just one quick one after that, and then we can wrap it up.
Yeah. So the last one was Suicide Squad. Number 4.
The original run?
Yeah.
I love this. This run.
Let's see here. So this has the cover is who brought a city to its knees, and it's got on the cover this character that looks like a colorful version of a medieval knight, kind of, with a crossbow, and there's a whole bunch of people behind him fighting, and a fire broken out in a city. You can recognize a couple of the Suicide Squad members behind him: Bronze Tiger, Captain Boomerang, Deadshot. This is of course by John Ostrander and Luke McDonnell. But it starts out with a armed robbery with a group of some white and some black people in the squad that's robbing, I think it's maybe a liquor store. And then this character from the beginning comes, he's using he's got a crossbow, but it's got like a technologically advanced bolt that he fires at the engine of the car. And he approaches and fights a bunch of the guys, knocks a bunch of them out. But then he tells the two white guys to go to the headquarters of a place of a group called the Aryan Empire. It's, he'll let them go if they'll do that. So that when the cops show up, he claims that the remaining two guys, which are the black guys, they're the only ones that he happened to catch. They were the only ones that he found, even though the cops said that they heard that there was five men involved in the robbery. And so he's this guy sticks around, and he's known as as William Hell, and he sticks around and actually talks to a reporter and says that he wants to be a symbol for the common man and overcome those who would destroy our hope, our peace, our way of life. So then we see him get picked up by a driver, take off his mask, and he's like a blonde-haired white guy underneath. His driver takes him home, and after it's a guy named Mr. Heller, and after Heller gets out and goes into his mansion, the guy gets out, his driver gets out of the car, opens the trunk, and the real driver is in the trunk, and he tells him, he tells the real driver, you picked up Mr. Heller tonight as normal, understand, and you're to remind him to call so and so. He gives him some instructions, and then we see this imposter driver leave the scene and start taking off her disguise, and it's the Black Orchid, a member of the Suicide Squad. So then it switches to a debriefing with Amanda Waller and the squad, and she explains about this W. James Weller, who's a rich and very right-wing businessman, who's been instigating racial tension in the city. And he's covertly openly funded many white survivalist, neo-Nazi, or other KKK groups, and he founded his own called the Aryan Empire. And that they have reason to believe that he and the vigilante William Hell is the same person. And so we're reminded that the Suicide Squad are not all upstanding citizens, and Captain Boomerang himself, who's Australian, says, well, that only stands to reason, don't it? I mean, it's a well-known fact that they do most of the crime, isn't it? And he's, by they, he's referring to the fact that Waller just was talking about how William Hell's arrests have consisted entirely of minorities. And Bronze Tiger says, the only known criminals I see here, my man, are white. And Captain Boomerang says he's talking about street crime. He's like, we're different, aren't we? And he uses the term Abbo, which I assume means Aborigine, being from Australia. I know there's like a lot of like racism and stuff against Aboriginal Australians and stuff. Waller says, we'll raise your social consciousness later, Boomerang, with an axe. So Deadshot says, well, why don't we just shoot the guy? And Waller's like, no, we're not, she doesn't want to make him a martyr to his cause. She wants to embarrass and discredit him. So she goes into like some of his history and like how he was raised by his grandfather, who was a Nazi, or like sold goods to the Nazis or something like that. And he inherited all of his grandfather's stuff, and they are going to like set something up at a rally that Heller is intending. So they stage a thing where Bronze Tiger is dressed up as like a as a super villain, and Captain Boomerang is there. And it's actually a really comical moment, because Captain Boomerang's been like given, he's been told what he's supposed to say, you know. And being Captain Boomerang, he says, his delivery is just really, really bad. He's, "I, Captain Boomerang, am glad I've returned to Central City. With my old nemesis, the Flash, no longer here, I am free to use me trick boomerangs and amazing skills to knock over this bleeding armored car." So this is a setup to draw William Hell out, and to his usual techniques, he sends Boomerang off to join the Aryan Empire, and just holds on to the who Bronze Tiger is pretending to be, and you know tells the police that show up that that's who the only person he caught. But the police are, it's not the real police, it's two of the Suicide Squad members. So Captain Boomerang ends up at this rally, and then Deadshot shows up pretending to be William Hell, surprising the real William Hell in his civilian identity, and he goes up on the podium and starts interrupts the speech and starts talking about basically like appeals to them in a different way by like their economic hardship. He's like, "Black, white, whatever, you're all the little guy. And any freedom they can take from the next guy, they can take from you." And but meanwhile, Heller goes off and puts on his costume and comes out and accuses the Deadshot of being an imposter and such. So they set up a test where Captain Boomerang, like based on the old William Tell myth, they both agree that they'll have a contest to shoot an apple off of Captain Boomerang's head. Deadshot makes the shot, and William Tell misses, though he's shocked that he did. Well, the whole thing, as we find out later, is a setup. They, Kronos is one of the Suicide Squad right now, and so he and the Enchantress did something that, you know, without bothering to explain it, they did something to cause Hell's bolt to go high. Captain Boomerang's not too excited to find out that Deadshot just took the shot on his own with his eyes closed. They set up a thing where it looks like the William Hell that Deadshot is impersonating is shot by one of Heller's men, but it's another Suicide Squad member in disguise, and they had just like a fake blood thing set up on Deadshot's chest and all that. Nightshade and Deadshot have an interesting conversation about the speech that he gave, like that Deadshot basically just manipulated them and preyed on their fears in the same way as Heller, but didn't do it with like a racist bent, like she's like, "That's, you know, that's how much better is that really?" And He's like, "Well, you got a problem with it? Talk to the colonel. He's the one that, he's the one that came up with the speech." And the colonel is, just like, "Is that your idea, patriotism?" And he's like, "No, not patriotism, but democracy. It's like, if people aren't banding together in common good, then maybe in self-interest." So it's kind of like a, it's interesting. Like, it doesn't end in like, "Oh, this is the neat tied up way that, you know." It's kind of like an interesting discussion between the characters and their different points of view. That it's like they were not shooting for the ideal, but just like a more practical goal. And whether that's like the right choice or not, kind of thing. But I thought it was interesting, something that was written in the mid-80s, like how relevant it still is.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it sounds like you read some good issues here.
Yeah, all good solid stuff, and like all kind of on the darker side of what DC was doing at the time,
Yeah,
actually.
for sure. There's a little bit of a theme going on.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, I just have one more movie, and I'll be fairly brief because we've been going for a bit. A couple nights ago, I watched on Shudder, I watched The Wax Mask from 1997, and this is a Italian horror movie. The screenplay by Lucio Fulci and the story by Dario Argento.
Those are
Fulci,
some famous Italian
yes.
horror guys.
Yeah. So apparently, just some background. Argento decided to help Fulci with this project because he hadn't been in good health.
Yeah, I was gonna say this is kind of like late, kind of late for both of them.
Very late, right? 97. Yeah. So anyhow, what ended up happening is Fulci ended up dying in 96. And so Argento ended up having a man by the name of Sergio Stivaletti to direct the film. So Fulci, and of course it was dedicated to Fulci, and he had the screenplay or credit, but he had died prior to them actually the beginning to actually create the movie or film the movie, I should say. So kind of interesting. What we've got here is the start of the movie. What we see straight out is some this man, all he's masked, robed. He's in a house, and he ends up killing a man and a woman, a husband and wife, and he's got like a metal claw that he literally like shoves his hand all the way into the chest and rips the heart out. And unbeknownst to him is that there was a witness to this young girl that was hiding under the bed as from when the husband, I'm assuming her father, yeah, well, I'll get into that in a bit. But basically, she witnessed the whole thing. So now this is maybe 20 years later, and we see a couple men in a Italian brothel, and they're in the lounge area, and they're chatting and talking about just what frightens you, what doesn't frighten, different effects of being scared and so forth. And the one man basically wagers against the other to go to the wax museum that's at a larger museum that's going to be opening or has just opened. overnight and stay there overnight. So he takes him up on that. He goes and he starts looking around, and there's basically what this wax museum features are like murder scenes. So all, you know, all the different people being killed in different scenarios. And he goes ahead and he looks there, and he ends up hearing some noise. He kind of hides, and at some point he hears the noise louder. He turns around, screams, and collapses. Us as the viewer didn't see anything, what he was reacting to, but then they find him the next morning dead. Somehow he'd been scared to death, assuming like a heart attack or something. So shortly thereafter, the wax museum director and his assistant are looking to hire a woman to do the costumes for the different wax, what do you call them? Just wax figures, I guess. And so they go ahead. They were interviewing a woman, and they seemed very happy about her qualifications. And as the assistant is escorting her out, notices that there's another woman waiting. So he tells the director, her name's Sonia. She comes in to be interviewed, and immediately the wax museum director is taken by this woman. And although the assistant assumed that she was going to be just briefly interviewed and escorted away, he immediately hires her on the spot. So it turns out that she is she's cared for by her blind aunt, and she starts working for the wax museum director. His name is Boris. I think I mentioned the woman's name is Sonia, and she starts seeing a reporter that is trying to look into this death at the wax museum. And they start to become romantic, but basically what you start to discover pretty quickly and really find out is the prostitute that was with the man who ended up having the heart attack, she decides to go also to the wax museum one day to look around, and she basically is knocked out, and the next thing she knows, she's downstairs in the basement, and she's restrained in a chair where what you see is it's a person just in a mask. He is basically drains her of blood and injects her with this fluid. So you see her being drained of blood, and she gets all like wrinkled and old looking and stuff, and looks like she's dead, but then it puts this fluid back in her, and then puts her back into looking the same. Apparently she still is alive, because like she's got eye movement and so forth, and you see this masked figure actually put like wax eyes over her own eyeballs so no one can see that she's moving. So it quickly becomes apparent anyhow that everyone these aren't wax statues at all, but they're all actual people that have been placed in these situations. So anyhow, the prostitute's now missing. An investigator starts asking questions and actually knows Sonia. It turns out, unsurprisingly, that Sonia is the little girl that had survived that massacre some 20 or so years before. And so he's fond of her. He knows her. He starts investigating her place of work, and at one point he comes back, and the wax museum director has decided to put together a new scene, and it's duplicating the scene from Sonia's parents being murdered, and down to details. And so Sonia sees this, passes out. The investigator sees it and obviously becomes very suspicious of the director of the wax museum, because there were details in there that the main public didn't know. So what it turns out is that it does a flashback of the wax museum director, Boris, him with his wife. He came into the house and saw his wife cheating on him, and he ends up like having a fit, and they start fighting, and he ends up like I don't even know what it was, but like falling into some like goop where there was like literally like his skin was just falling off of him. So what it turns out is that Boris is basically making wax things of his own self. He interchanges different faces if he wants to be in disguise. But that's where this metal like hand had been coming from the beginning scene, is that he hadn't disguised his hands. If you want to picture like a really like a primitive version of like the Terminator, like that exoskeleton or endoskeleton type thing, that's kind of what it looks like. Like his whole body is like kind of like he's got a, like a artificial skeleton around him and so forth. But anyhow, Boris ends up killing the inspector. The reporter and Sonia end up trying to pick up the investigation, but Boris captures Sonia, and it's implied, although never said, that Sonia is actually his child, rather than the man that had died, that was probably just like a stepfather. But he captures her and is now going to start the process of turning her into a wax figure as well. But the reporter gets there just in time, brings the police. The whole place starts, goes up into flames, and you see like his entire, Boris's entire body like melting down into just nothing but a metal skeleton, and they manage to escape. Now, not only this, but Boris gets his head chopped off of the rest of his skeleton, and they like smash his head, apparently killing him and destroying his brain. However, when they all leave the museum, when Sonia and the reporter leave the museum, you see that what had happened, or what's implied that had happened, is that it was actually his assistant that also had this, and that's who they had killed. And you see Boris in his regular face just walking away and leaving the burning museum, just like walking by. And that's the end of the movie. It actually was fairly entertaining. It was a little slow going here or there, but I enjoyed it. I gave it a 6 out of 10. That would just convert to a solid 3 out of 5. I didn't really love it, but I enjoyed it for what it was, and I thought it was fairly interesting. It held my attention for the most part. Yeah, definitely not a bad movie.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all I got.
A review quote on Wikipedia says it kind of is like a return to an older fashioned kind of movie, like from the 70s or something.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, that's 100%. I actually, when I was watching it, I didn't pay attention to when it was. And then when I was getting ready for talking to you this morning, I'm like, oh, you know what? I gotta check the. So maybe I'll cover that one first because that's probably the oldest of the movies. Look, I'm like 97. I'm like, oh my god. Yeah. Figured it was like 73 or something. Like that would have been my guess. It's like 73. That's exactly how it was filmed. And of course, because it is like a period movie, it wasn't set in the present day by any means. It was set, you know, that you couldn't tell that.
Can't pick up
wasn't.
By like the type of Pepsi can they have sitting there.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. It was all like set in like early 1900s, you know, Italy. So it's like I had no idea. I just assumed it was like an early 70s movie. It's exactly how it was filmed. It's funny that that's what it said because that's spot on. It was the more that I'm talking about it with you, the more that I feel like I enjoyed it than like how like that night when the movie was over.
Yeah,
that happens to me sometimes. It's just like, you know, as I start discussing it, I'm like, well, that actually was pretty good.
Maybe before you rate stuff on IMDb now, you have to talk to somebody about it for 15 minutes or more.
I think so, because I think I probably would give it higher than a 6 at this point. But it was good. I enjoyed it. But it was nice talking to you, Chris. I'm glad you were able to hear this. Yeah.
We'll see whether we can fit another one in before Christmas or...
I know.
What happens, but...
It's going to get tough, I know.
Yeah, but either way, enjoy the rest of your Sunday, and I'm sure I'll be talking to you.
Should we tell everyone where they can reach us?
Oh yeah, we're doing a podcast. That's right.
I know you. Well, you can reach Mike at Mike Myers Brunch on Twitter, and at Rob Krieger, and you are Mythmaking ETC, correct?
Yep.
And I think that's it. I'm not sure. Oh, he's got. Mike's got the Facebook page too for Geek Brunch.
Yep.
Am I forgetting anything?
No, that's pretty much it. Twitter is the main place.
Yeah.
So that'll do it. Thanks for remembering.
Sure, no problem. You would yell at us if we didn't do that.
Yeah. We don't want to get in trouble for the boss.
No. Be replaced.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, sounds good.
Yeah. Have a great Sunday, and talk to you in a couple weeks.
Okay.
All right,
too.
Take care. Yep.
Bye.